Good morning. In re detention of WC.
Thank you, yes. Kathleen Shea. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Apologize. Kathleen Shea for the appellant, Your Honors, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And if I may, I find that in discussing this case, it is difficult to do so without a calendar in front of me from December of 2013. So I would like to pass that up to the court. Your Honors, this is a case where WC was detained for up to 72 hours under the civil commitment statute on December 20th, 2013. At the time, he was 70 years old. He had suffered several heart attacks, had a pacemaker, and he was living in a supportive housing facility for individuals with mental illness. The staff reported that there were problems, namely that he had punched another resident in the throat and that he had made threatening comments toward a staff member. They referred him for a petition for commitment. Under the statute, under RCW 7105-180, an individual can be detained for evaluation and treatment for a period not to exceed 72 hours. This period of time, the 72 hours, excludes Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. Before the 72 hours expired, Harborview filed a petition for a 14-day commitment. So within that period of time, they filed the petition, and a hearing was initially set the following Tuesday on December 24th. If requested by the party representing the individual who is to be committed.
I think I'd like to speed you up because we really do understand the facts here. You need to focus on why the Civil Rule 6 doesn't apply in this case, because this all turns, it appears, on the correctness of excluding holidays and weekends from the time computations.
Well, Your Honor, because first of all, there is a mental proceeding rule that specifically addresses this. There is mental health proceeding rule 2.1, which specifically talks about timing and when it is allowed
subject
to grant
subject to the statute.
Subject to the statute, correct.
240.
Right, yes.
It doesn't cite 180.
It does not cite to 180. It cites to 240.
240 doesn't have a specific rule about time.
240 does not have a specific rule about time, but it does specifically address how long you can postpone a hearing. So there is a discussion of time. In fact, that is the only discussion of time about how long you can postpone a hearing.
So it's silent about whether you exclude weekends or holidays or include them.
But I think that silence was intentional on the part of the legislature.
And how do you conclude that?
Well, for one, I mean, I think it's important to look at, you know, the court's discussion in Swanson when it discusses the fact that we have a situation where everything is set up in terms of hours prior to appearing in front of a judge. And then in the civil commitment statute, everything beyond that, once you've appeared in front of a judge, is defined in terms of days. That's important. They're recognizing the fact that the legislature was very concerned about how long an individual would be detained before that individual saw a judge. And this is the case, this is the situation here. We have 72 hours that excludes weekends and holidays according to 180. But then under 240, which talks about the postponement, we're talking about once again making it harder to keep continuing this case out before the individual is able to ever see a judge.
But the same rule is not repeated there. You're asking us to draw a conclusion or apply a rule of construction?
Yes. I'm asking you to, yes, construct the statute according to its language, which I would submit here is plain and unambiguous.
You know the legislative history of that exclusion of weekends and holidays?
No, unfortunately, I'm not prepared to address that.
It originally explicitly included holidays and Sundays. It didn't need to because Saturdays were court days when it was enacted.
Okay.
And then it excluded Saturdays when Saturdays were no longer court days.
I understand that. That would make sense.
And then it reversed the inclusion and made it an exclusion. But it didn't need to do that for the other sections because the civil rules already excluded those days.
Well, Your Honor, you know, and one thing I would like to...
I'm just saying it extinguishes, it's a reason to ignore a construction by implication from that statute.
Well, I guess I'm not sure that that goes to the fact that they I guess I'm trying to understand why then, why you're saying that that would lend itself to finding that the 48 hours
it would make, still. Because then it would have made it imperative to include and to state the opposite in the other section, wouldn't it?
Well, and certainly they could have then gone back, though, and included that same exclusion. And they chose not to. They chose to only apply it to the 72 hours, not the 48 hours. One thing I would like to address the court on, in preparing for this hearing and looking at my briefing, I do think that to some degree, when I'm looking back at this statute, I'm not sure that I correctly identified. I was looking at this, and this is apparently how the court is operating, in terms of there's this 72 hours, and then there's this 48-hour postponement. When you actually go back and read these statutes, when they work together, we're actually looking at the fact that the hearing needs to be held within 72 hours. That 72-hour hearing was scheduled for the 24th. You can then postpone that hearing 48 hours. I just think it's important to address the court on this, because when I'm looking at actually what the statutes say, really then we're looking at a period of time where that 48 hours only should have been extended 48 hours past the 24th, not past the 72-hour cutoff, if we're looking at the clear language of the statute. You have the hearing, and then you have the postponement. The statute doesn't actually allow for a computation of 48 hours plus 72 hours, which is what I was initially relying on in my briefing. But I would have to say, upon looking at the statute, that's not actually correct. Either way, we're far. This 10-day detention of WC is far beyond what was anticipated. But if we're looking at this, we don't even need to get, the court does not even need to get to the exclusion of holidays and weekends, because even if the hearing was set for the 24th and we exclude the holiday the 25th, the hearing should not have gone any longer. That 48-hour period then expired on the 27th, that Friday. And that actually, I think, is probably a correct reading of the statute. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Wong. I'm here on behalf of the responding party in this case, which is the hospital. It sounds like Your Honors are very well-versed in the facts of this case, so I won't necessarily repeat them, but I think what's fairly critical, as Your Honors can see, is that both the court as well as the hospital did everything they possibly could to move the hearing forward, and it essentially was an anomaly that there was a conflict of interest in this particular case which required new counsel and competent counsel, I might add, to be appointed, which, given that it was the Christmas holiday, apparently was not available, which in fact was the cause for the delay. So the end result of this case clearly should not simply be the strict construction, and because there's no attorney period,
but
the case should just be
dismissed. Court rule for special proceedings says the statute applies.
Sure. So if I could.
So why should we apply CR 6?
Well, CR 6, again, as I think Your Honor correctly identified, these are civil proceedings. They're not criminal proceedings, and obviously the civil rules apply to civil proceedings, which do include weekends and holidays. One of the points I was reflecting a little bit about as I looked at the calendar, much like Ms. Shea did, is that, again, I acknowledge the hearing needs to be scheduled, and I would disagree that the hearing needs to be held, but needs to be scheduled within the first 72 hours. So if we look at when Mr. W.C. was detained, which was the 20th, if we exclude the weekends and the holidays, actually 72 hours would be the 26th, the Thursday. So I suggest it's somewhat fortuity that it was, in fact, scheduled on the 24th. In fact, the 26th was by when it could have been scheduled, and by that sort of extension, if we do the 48 hours on top of that, which excludes the weekends, in fact, we fall within the construction of the statute, presuming, again, that that was, in fact, a strict construction argument. I think that the respondent would contend that, in fact, this is not a strict construction issue. I realize that it's unpublished, but I know Your Honors have reviewed a similar issue in In Re JG, which, again, dealt with good cause continuances, and, again, the same.
Does the hearing have to be completed within 72 hours?
The state would argue.
But if it was a four-day hearing?
Right. That would be the state's argument. It is no, Your Honor. I've never heard of that before. In fact, that's a new argument to me, and I suggest that.
So if it doesn't have to be completed, then do we read the statute to mean that it has to start?
I would disagree with that contention, Your Honor, and I would draw your...
My next question would be, what does it mean to start it?
Exactly, and that would be perfectly applicable in this case, for example. I think the record reflects on the 24th, the state said, all right, ready, let's go ahead. And defense said, well, I can't go forward because there's a conflict. So, again, how is the state possibly going to start the hearing with no defense counsel?
Well, or is that the start of the hearing?
Well, debatably, yes, Your Honor. I think it would be one contention to say yes. As the state is ready to proceed under Swanson, that would be the start of the hearing, debatably. Alternatively, if Your Honors do not believe that is, in fact, any sort of substantive action on the hearing, as there's obviously no openings and such done, again, it makes no sense for the state to do opening if defense is going to go, well, I'm conflicting out anyway, so you're talking to nobody. I suggest the more practical example is that the parties were clearly ready to proceed under
Swanson. In fact, you really couldn't do opening if there wasn't counsel able, because there would be no one to object.
Exactly. Right. And again, I think the problem arises here in that
is there any guidance on when one of these hearings starts?
I think Swanson simply says when the parties are ready, Your Honor. And again, we find ourselves in a unique circumstance because, again, the state is ready and the defense cannot be ready due to the conflict. And I don't believe there's any guidance either way as to when the hearing would start if one party is not.
Was the presiding officer for this an elected judge?
Yes, it was Judge Andrews. Yes, and I think you'll see throughout, there's sort of two transcripts. The first transcript when Judge Andrews first makes the motion that, or allows the motion
there
to
are,
continue.
There are some counties that handle a lot of these, especially during times like Christmas holidays.
Sure.
With retired judges who sit as pro tems. And in fact, I've seen cases from King County where Judge Wartnick has done that in this circumstance. That would require, however, someone to consent. Would a hearing start with the request for consent? And what would happen if there wasn't anybody, presumably the person that the government thinks is without their mental faculties would not be able to validly consent on their own?
Sure.
So if there wasn't counsel who would had the authority to consent because they had a conflict,
right,
would that be the start of the hearing, or would that mean the hearing couldn't start because no one could consent, or how would we view these things?
Sure.
I'm trying to figure out things that are going to come up. I'm
sure.
Getting more of these.
Yeah, I see your point, Your Honor, and I suggest that that's sort of the conundrum exactly in this position, and that, again, these are very specialized cases, not just, you can't just grab any attorney and say, well, you stand in, and again, this is necessarily in the record, but, you know, with OPD the way it is, TDA, is sort of the entity that does these types of cases. ACA are the attorneys that commonly will conflict in. There's three or four of them. Again, if you simply hired a private counsel to come up, presuming that was even the case, that person would presumably say, well, I immediately need a continuance because I need to know what to do. So to draw it back to Your Honor's example, that's correct. So we try to start the hearing. There's no conflict-free counsel at this point. We need to find competent counsel to do that because obviously the person who is either pro se or is stuck with a conflicted attorney can't make any objections on himself. There's no way anybody can do anything. So it creates this conundrum where Swanson is the only guiding authority, which says, well, we'd start if both parties are ready. We have the hospital ready to proceed, but of course it's completely unfair and it in fact tramples on the respondent's rights to force him to go forward.
I'm not trying to get too ethereal in this, but Judge Wartnick comes out. I'm
sure.
Just picking on Judge Wartnick because I know he's actually done this.
So no,
Judge Wartnick comes out and he's dressed in black and everything.
Sure.
And sits, I don't know if he sits up high or just sits down with everybody else, but assumes the spot and says, okay, now this is the stage where we need everybody to consent that we proceed here.
Right.
And you sign off for the state, and then he finds out whether we have one person here who is believed there's question what about their competency.
Yes.
So I have concerns about them consenting, and then this other attorney saying I can't consent because I have a conflict with the client. Is that the start of a hearing, or is that before a hearing? And if that's before a hearing, what is it?
I think the hospital's position would be no, the hearing has not started because, again, there's no substantive action that can be taken, but that a continuance in that case would be warranted in order to have all parties being prepared. I think it would be difficult to say the hearing started if one side has not had the opportunity to
prepare. What if there was conflict-free counsel?
Okay.
And he said, you know what, Judge Wartnick, I never thought much of you. I'm not going to consent.
Okay. Well, then
has a hearing started because there's been a request for action and now it has to stop, or has no hearing started?
I would suggest that in that case, the hearing, well, I'm going to draw you a little bit of a distinction here. Again, I'm going to cite to Swanson. I think that the hearing has started for the purposes that now both parties are, in fact, ready. In that sense, yes, the hearing would have started. Practically speaking, has any substantive action been taken at that point? Clearly not, unless there's some sort of affidavit of prejudice.
Well, I'm trying to explore your notion of the substantive action, because that's something that could happen, right?
So I guess
the ordinance could come out on December 24th.
So I guess
then what if everybody from TDA said, man, you always find our people are not winning.
So to me, that's somewhat tantamount to an affidavit of prejudice. So in that sense, yes, the hearing would have started.
But it's not. I mean, it's not, because it's that's something that, and
okay.
I prefer to call it a motion for change of judge.
Sure.
That applies to someone who's elected and serving their term, right? So here we have someone who was previously elected but not serving a term, and so it requires consent.
Okay.
But is the request for consent the start of the proceeding, or does it not start until after you've consented? And if that's so, what in the world is it before?
Under your fact set, Your Honor, yes, I would argue that the hearing has in fact began, as both parties are in fact ready to proceed, and they have made a proactive action on the case. Again, the case obviously cannot be completed within the 72 hours given what the request was, but I do believe that under those facts, the hearing would have in fact started, as the parties, again, are ready to proceed.
And so we've got some sort of an idea when it starts.
Yes. Okay. I see I have less than a minute left. If Your Honors have specific questions, I'm happy to address those. Otherwise, I think Your Honors sort of understand the scenario as it stands. Okay. I will sit down. Thank you very much. We would ask the court to affirm then in this case.
I'd like to, I guess, address this issue of whether the hearing needs to be completed or held. If I was saying in my language that it needed to be completed, that's not what I was intending to say to the court. I am talking about actually starting the hearing.
What does that mean?
Well, as the state has said, I think Swanson does provide guidance on that in terms of a discussion about the call of the calendar and the parties being ready to proceed. That, of course, is both parties.
Well, how about the discussion I had with counsel here that, So Judge Wortnick walks out, and everybody from one of the defender agencies decides we're not going to consent to Judge Wortnick. And it's December 24th. Does that mean everybody just leaves the hospital at that point?
Well, in that case, I think you are asking for a postponement of the hearing then. You are asking, that is different than saying a hearing that begins at 4:30 in the afternoon
and
continues on.
Was it a postponement, or did it start? Did it start when Judge Wharton said, will you consent?
I would argue that no, it doesn't start until you actually begin the hearing.
So the refusal to consent took part in what proceeding?
I'm sorry?
Well, everybody's there.
Yes.
Got a guy dressed in black. It's some kind of a proceeding, right?
Yes, and so
You're
I think...
You're saying it's not the hearing.
Well,
what is it?
What I'm saying is I think that the language in Swanson gets tricky, because what they're looking at in Swanson is a hearing that just started later in the day, right? But what we're talking about here is that this hearing is not going to be able to begin that day. So we're no longer talking about just the parties being prepared for the call of the calendar. I would suggest that, no, the hearing couldn't possibly have begun that day if that judge is not going to preside over it. And I do just want to emphasize for the record here that, while I appreciate all of this, there is this issue of the fact that, in this case, no notice of appearance was filed until the 30th. So we have a notice of appearance by counsel being filed on December 30th, 10 days after WC is detained. He is someone that does not have counsel. And this suggestion that perhaps, it would be difficult to find other counsel, there are two other public defender agencies that could have been contacted and were not. This is an individual that did not have counsel at any point during a period of time where he was held and had not been in front of a judge.
Counsel had been appointed. They hadn't appeared.
Well, so it's interesting. So, yes, counsel had been appointed but had never filed a notice of appearance and then needed to withdraw. And then ACA was appointed but never filed a notice of appearance or a request for discovery until the 30th, which, again, is noteworthy because it goes to the fact that attorneys come in all the time. This attorney from ACA came in, just like they do all the time on these cases, filed the notice of appearance, request for discovery, and had the hearing. So there is no preparation that is often taken for these cases. We'd ask that the court reverse. Thank you.